In spite of all this, as I mentioned in my letter, I was never able to feel at the time that I was wronging you in any way. What I was doing seemed entirely natural to me, though I can only imagine that it was not the real me that felt that way. Could this be true, though? Is the answer really so simple? And if so, what, then, is the real me? Do I have any sound basis for concluding that the me who is now writing this letter is the real me? I was never able to believe all that firmly in myself, nor am I able to today. I often used to dream of you, vivid dreams with clear-cut stories. In these dreams you were always searching desperately for me. We were in a kind of labyrinth, and you would come almost up to where I was standing. "Take one more step. I'm right here," I wanted to shout. "And if only you would find me and take me in your arms, the nightmare would end and everything would go back to the way it was." But I was never able to produce that shout. And you would miss me in the darkness and go straight past me and disappear. It was always like that, but still, those dreams helped and encouraged me. At least I knew I still had the power to dream. My brother couldn't prevent me from doing that. I was able to sense that you were doing everything in your power to draw nearer to me. Maybe someday you would find me and hold me and sweep away the filth that was clinging to me and take me away from that place forever. Maybe you would smash the curse and replace the seal so that the real me would never have to leave again. That was how I was able to keep a tiny flame of hope alive in that cold, dark place with no exit. How I was able to preserve the tiniest remnant of my own voice. I received the password for access to this computer this afternoon. Someone sent it to me, special delivery. I'm sending you this message from the machine in my brother's office. I hope it reaches you. I have run out of time. The taxi is waiting for me outside. I have to leave for the hospital now, to kill my brother and take my punishment. Strange, I no longer hate my brother. I am calm with the thought that I will have to obliterate his life from this world. I have to do it for his sake, too, and to give my own life meaning. Take good care of the cat. I can't tell you how happy I am that he is back. You say his name is Mackerel? I like that. He was always a symbol of something good that grew up between us. We should not have lost him when we did. I can't write any more now. Goodbye.
39. Goodbye.
I'm so sorry I couldn't show you the duck people, Mr. Wind-Up Bird.
Mei Kasahara looked truly sorry.
She and I were sitting by the pond, looking at its thick cap of ice. It was a big pond, with thousands of little cuts on its surface from skating blades. Mei Kasahara had taken this Monday morning off work, especially for me. I had intended to visit her on Sunday, but a train accident had made me a day late. Mei Kasahara had wrapped herself in a fur-lined coat. Her bright blue woolen hat bore a geometrical design in white yarn and was topped with a little pom-pom. She had knitted the hat herself, and she said she would make one just like it for me before next winter. Her cheeks were red, her eyes as bright and clear as the surrounding air, which made me very happy. She was only 17, after all. The potential was there for almost limitless change.
The duck people all moved somewhere else after the pond froze over. I'm sure you would have loved them. Come back in the spring, will you? I'll introduce you.
I smiled. I was wearing a duffel coat that was not quite warm enough, with a scarf wrapped up to my cheeks, and my hands thrust in my pockets. A deep chill ran through the forest. Hard snow coated the ground. My trainers were sliding all over the place. I should have bought some kind of non-slip boots for this trip.
So you're going to stay here a while longer?
I asked.
I think so. I might want to go back to school after enough time has gone by. Or I might not. I don't know. I might just get married. No, not really.
She smiled with a white puff of breath.
But anyhow, I'll stay for now. I need more time to think. About what I want to do, where I want to go. I want to take time and think about those things.
I nodded. Maybe that's what you really ought to do, I said.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, did you think about those kinds of things when you were my age?
Maybe not. I must have thought about them a little bit, but I really don't remember thinking about things as seriously as you do. I suppose I just thought that if I went on living in the usual way, things would work themselves out all right. But they didn't, did they? Unfortunately. Mei Kasahara looked me in the eye, a calm expression on her face. Then she laid her gloved hands on her lap, one on top of the other.
So in the end, they wouldn't let Kumiko out of jail?
She asked. She refused to be let out, I said. She figured she'd be mobbed. Better to stay in jail where she could have peace and quiet. She's not even seeing me. She doesn't want to see anyone until everything is settled.
When does the trial start?
Sometime in the spring. Kumiko is pleading guilty. She's going to accept the verdict, whatever it is. It shouldn't be a long trial, and there's a good possibility of a suspended sentence. Or at worst, a light one. Mei Kasahara picked up a stone at her feet and threw it towards the middle of the pond. It clattered across the ice to the other side.
And you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? You'll stay at home? And wait for Kumiko again?
I nodded.
That's good. Or is it?
I made my own big white cloud in the cold air. I don't know. I suppose it's how we worked things out. It could have been a whole lot worse, I told myself. Far off in the woods that surrounded the pond, a bird cried. I looked up and scanned the area, but there was nothing more to hear. Nothing to see. There was only the dry, hollow sound of a woodpecker drilling a hole in a tree trunk. If Kumiko and I have a child, I'm thinking of naming it Corsica, I said.
What a great name,
said Mei Kasahara. As the two of us walked through the woods side by side, Mei Kasahara took off her right glove and put her hand in my pocket. This reminded me of Kumiko. She often used to do the same thing when we walked together in the winter, so we could share a pocket on a cold day. I held Mei Kasahara's hand in my pocket. It was a small hand, and warm as a sequestered soul.
You know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, everybody's going to think we're lovers.
You may be right.
So tell me, did you read all my letters?
Your letters? I had no idea what she was talking about. Sorry, but I've never received a single letter from you. I got your address and phone number from your mother, which wasn't easy. I had to stretch the truth quite a bit.
Oh, no! Where did they all go? I must have written you 500 letters!
Mei Kasahara looked up to the heavens. Late that afternoon, Mei Kasahara saw me all the way to the station. We took a bus into town, ate pizza at a restaurant near the station, and waited for the little three-carriage diesel train that finally pulled in. Two or three people stood around the big wood-burning stove that glowed red in the waiting room, but the two of us stayed out on the platform in the cold. A clear, hard-edged winter moon hung frozen in the sky. It was a young moon, with a sharp curve like a Chinese sword. Beneath that moon, Mei Kasahara stood on tiptoe and kissed me on the cheek. I could feel her cold, thin lips touch me where my mark had been.
Goodbye, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
she murmured.
Thanks for coming all the way out here to see me.
Hands thrust deep in my pockets, I looked into her eyes. I didn't know what to say. When the train came, she slipped her hat off, took one step back, and said to me,
If anything ever happens to you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, just call out to me in a really loud voice, okay? to me and the duck people?
Goodbye, Mei Kasahara, I said. The arc of the moon stayed over my head long after the train had left the station, appearing and disappearing each time the train rounded a curve. I kept my eyes on the moon, and whenever that was lost to sight, I watched the lights of the little towns as they went past the window. I thought of Mei Kasahara with her blue woolen hat, alone on the bus, taking her back to her factory in the hills. Then I thought of the duck people, asleep in the grassy shadow somewhere. And finally, I thought of the world that I was heading back to. Goodbye, Mei Kasahara, I said. Goodbye, Mei Kasahara. May there always be something watching over you. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep. But it was not until much later that I was able to get any real sleep. In a place far away from anyone or anywhere, I drifted off for a moment.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami. This program was directed by Roy McMillan. Executive producers, Nicholas Soames and Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 1998 by Haruki Murakami. Production copyright 2006, Naxos Audiobooks. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.